Good morning and welcome to Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU Cincinnati. It's Saturday, May 31st, and I'm Katie Orr. This morning, you may think your fake Fendi is harmless, but do you know where your money is really going when you buy that purse? You'll find out when Chris DeSimio talks with the author of Rogue Economics, Capitalism's New Reality. And JT Roberts, general manager of the Cincinnati Kings soccer team, drops by to talk about the new season. Also this hour, we'll look at a couple of education-related issues. First, we'll take up the argument of whether college is really for everyone, and then learn why everything you know about English is wrong. After the news. And now, with a look back at some of this week's other top news stories, here's Jay Hanselman.
Ohio Governor Ted Strickland has tapped the dean of the Ohio State University Law School to serve as attorney general after a sexual harassment scandal forced out the previous AG. Strickland says Nancy Harden Rogers will lead the office for about 6 months. He says Rogers is taking a leave of absence from Ohio State to right the ship in the attorney general's office.
By appointing Ohio's attorney general, a woman of great integrity, accomplishment, intellect, humility, dignity, experience, and maturity, I believe that we are taking an important step to restore orderliness and confidence in the office of Ohio's Attorney General.
Strickland says she has no plans to run in the November election. Rogers says she shares the governor's goal for her tenure.
It's a shame that the actions of a limited number of persons who did not live up to these values have undermined the public confidence in this office. It has led some to doubt that the Attorney General still carries the moral authority that is needed to serve the people of Ohio. The situation must be turned around quickly.
The Democratic Party must still select a candidate to run for the remaining 2 years left in the term of former Attorney General Mark Dan. He resigned earlier this month after leading an office that was rocked by sexual harassment complaints, marks of unprofessionalism, and his own affair with a subordinate. While Delta Airlines and Northwest Airlines forge ahead with plans to merge, Delta subsidiary Comair is moving forward with confidence that it will remain an integral part of Delta's network of regional flyers. Comair says it's making steady progress in cutting $35 million in costs this year as part of Delta's overall cost-cutting in response to high fuel prices. The company recently announced it won't have to cut back as much as expected on aircraft and flights. The Erlanger-based airline also is adding income by providing contract work and ground handling and maintenance for other airlines. The Hamilton County Commission this week voted to reinstate a program aimed at fixing up aging homes and businesses. The county's Home Improvement Program, or HIP, was suspended earlier this year during budget deliberations. The program provides low-interest loans to owners of residential or commercial properties valued at $350,000 or less. The money must go towards improvements or repairs. Commission President Todd Portune says HIP has an added benefit aside from restoring buildings.
A report that has been put together by County Regional Planning assessing the full impact of the Home Improvement Loan Program has identified that it has been successful in increasing property tax revenues in the county over the life of the program.
Portune says HIP has generated more than $4 million in property tax revenue since it began in 2002. About 2,000 loans have been issued. The average amount is around $29,000. Kentucky Governor Steve Beshear has ordered ethics reform aimed at preserving integrity and accountability in the state's executive branch. Beshear signed an executive order this week imposing changes to the Kentucky Ethics Code. The governor tried unsuccessfully to persuade the state's General Assembly to pass changes earlier this year. Beshear's order requires state employees to undergo ethics training and shuffles the way members are appointed to a state ethics panel. Last November, Beshear ousted former Republican Governor Ernie Fletcher in an election centered on ethics. The Ohio House this week passed a bill lifting the burden of proof from people who kill intruders in their homes or cars. The vote sends the bill back to the Senate, which must consider numerous changes the House made to Ohio's concealed weapons law. Those include giving gun owners who don't have a concealed weapons permit the ability to carry unloaded rifles in their cars. That's the Week in Review. I'm Jay Hanselman, 91.7 WVXU.
Cincinnati native and acclaimed jazz pianist Fred Hirsch and his trio headline 91.7 WVXU's second annual Sweet Love, a tribute to OT concert in celebration of the life of our friend Oscar Treadwell. The concert's Thursday, June 12th, 7:30 at the Corbett Auditorium at UC's CCM campus. Proceeds benefit the CCM Jazz Department and WVXU. Tickets available through the Cincinnati Arts Association at 513-621-ARTS, cincinnatiarts.org, and the Aronoff Center and Music Hall ticket offices.
For her new book, Rogue Economics, journalist Loretta Napoleoni talked to banking executives in New York, Russian prostitutes, and London morgue workers. This morning, she's talking to Chris DeSimio.
Another week gone by on Wall Street, where money changes hands in the trillions of dollars, much of which made possible through the burgeoning technology that allows for share volumes to be in the now billions per day, numbers that were thought, considered unattainable not too long ago. However, there is a dark underside to the benefits brought to us by technology, and that world of Rogue Economics is actually explored in the title of Loretta Napoleoni's latest book, Rogue Economics. Loretta, gaining critical acclaim for her book, the best-selling Terror Incorporated, Tracing the Money Behind the Global Terrorism. Loretta is a native of Rome, Italy, and she is a consultant for governments around the world in the field of money laundering. And Loretta, thank you so much for being with us this Saturday morning.
Well, thank you so much for inviting me.
Loretta, tell us the benefits that technology has brought to all of us in terms of being able to send goods and services over vast distances almost instantly, it's a double-edged sword, isn't it?
Yes. I mean, I say in the book, it's a mixed blessing. Because, the Internet gives us the possibility to communicate very quickly in real time, to keep up with news in real time also. But at the same time, it also creates the ideal condition for these dark economic forces to blossom. And one example is the Internet currencies, for example, that they are used by people who access pornography, who access child pornography. In fact, that is one of the biggest business on the Internet.
There's a lot of money involved in a lot of these wholesome enterprises, online gambling, online gaming, which seems pretty innocuous, is big money. How much money is involved in some of these businesses?
Well, online gaming, we're talking about trillions of dollars, really. And the truth is that most of the servers of online gaming are based offshore, so they are untouchable. And that's one of the problems of globalization within the Internet. And then from those servers, people can gamble everywhere in the world. So in the United States, for example, where it is prohibited to gamble online, people can gamble online by simply gambling through these servers, which can be offshore any place, from China to Europe. And the legislation in the United States that can't do anything about that. So that's, I think, the key issue is who controls the Internet, which authority can actually affect the Internet, and the answer is none.
You talk about the Chinese currency miners, Mr. XXX, a 15-year-old spending time online. Tell us about the world of these Chinese gold farmers.
Yes, I interview XXX is his nickname, of course, and I interview him for my book. And it was very interesting because he is a gold farmer. So basically what he does is spend this day playing war games on the Internet, earning gold coins. The gold coins are used to buy armors, war instruments, anything that is needed in this virtual warfare. Now, it is illegal, of course, to sell these gold coins, but there is a secondary market which is huge because there are people like XXX, which are employed by companies, who actually do that. I mean, sell these gold coins for real money on the Internet. And the sale takes place through Internet currencies. So you can't actually track any of these transactions. There is also widespread money laundering activities taking place through these Internet currencies. And again, you know, there is nothing we can do about that because there is not authority in position in order to track this money or even to punish people that are doing this activity.
To one extent, Loretta, are some governments, if not actively condoning and supporting it, to what extent are some governments sort of turning a blind eye and allowing this to happen?
Well, there are governments that are turning a blind eye. For example, in China, where Internet is restricted for what concern information, there is nothing done in order to curb the secondary market of gold coins. Now, the Chinese market is the biggest market in the world because the number of people who are actually working in this industry are, you know, the largest number is in China. Why these governments don't do anything? Because this generates money for the economy, and they are only interested in their own economy. They do not consider the consequences of these kind of activities at global level. They also do not consider these activities illegal because, you know, it's generating cash for their own economy.
Sure. How often do investors trying to do the right thing by investing in, you know, quality enterprises and companies that are doing legitimate business, how often do people unwittingly discover that they might be owning a company that does business with some of these stalwart citizens?
Well, yeah, it really happens very often. Because of globalization, the chain, let's say, of companies from, you know, the one you're investing in to, you know, the one that actually is at the end of the chain is so long that often it's actually impossible, you know, to track them all down. Now, it is true that a conscientious investor should verify where he's investing his money. But the truth is that often the investor doesn't even know who is investing his own money. I mean, look at, you know, the funds, for example, pension funds. And I think, you know, a good example of this pension fund is what is happening also with the subprime. I mean, a lot of people put money in pension funds, and these pension funds invested in high-risk mortgage-backed securities. Now, how many people knew about that? Now that, you know, the crisis is happening, people are discovering that they're losing money because, you know, their money were badly invested. But how many people knew that before?
Yeah. Is there a link between the world of subprime borrowing where some of the some operators were offering mortgages to people who otherwise couldn't qualify at rates that were, you know, somewhat onerous? Is there a connection between some of the worst players in the subprime world and the dark forces you describe in rogue economics?
Oh, yes, of course. I mean, this is a clear example of rogue economics. I mean, and the reason why I say that is because in this subprime meltdown, nobody really broke any law because there were no laws in place. there was no legislation that imposed upon banks a certain degree of risk. And, you know, above that degree of risk, banks should not intervene, should not invest. Now, there wasn't. And I think this is one of the best examples because, you know, rogue economics really is not a criminal economy. It's not an illegal economy. It is the gray area.
Yeah, it's that area that operates between the bright sunlight favored by regulatory agencies and the deep darkness figured by the by organized crime. Tell us this globalization, Loretta. You talk about the extravagant force of globalization and the extent to which you know, money is used on a global basis to support gang warfare, not only here in the United States, but around the world.
Yes, I have noticed through my research that a natural reaction to globalization at any level, it is retrenching within tribalism. So people are afraid of globalization because they don't know, because it's a new phenomenon. So, you know, they retrench into tribalism. And the example of the gangs is perhaps, you know, the best example to describe this phenomenon. People join gangs because the gangs becomes the surrogate of their family. And within these gangs, violence becomes a sort of umbrella under which people can exist. And violence is violence within the gang, but also against the enemy, which is the other gangs. And now this is, I describe as the extravagant force of globalization, because in reality, you know, it goes against the principle of globalization. We should be globalizing, while in reality, you know, we're retrenching within, you know, tribalism.
Okay, so tribalism then, as evidenced by gang activity, tribalism can take numbers of forms, both with gangs and also there are certain countries in which try to retrench back, yes, back into the world of tribalism. A lot of interesting information here, Loretta. I want to thank you so much for spending part of your Saturday morning to be with us today.
Well, thank you so much. It was a pleasure.
Yeah. Loretta Napoleone, whose book Rogue Economics is available online and in a bookseller near you. For Cincinnati Edition, I'm Chris DeSimeo on The Money.
She's interviewed the famous and infamous. She's Terry Gross. 91.7 WVXU is proud to bring Terry Gross to Cincinnati for one night only, Thursday, June 19th at the Aronoff Center. Tickets, including VIP tickets with a pre-show reception, are on sale now through the Cincinnati Arts Association, 513-621-ARTS or cincinnatiarts.org. An evening with Terry Gross is presented by National City with support from Duke Energy.
Obtaining a college degree has long been held up as one of the pillars of the American dream. It's right up there with a fancy career, large house, and 2.5 kids. But graduating from college can be tough, and not just financially. In the June issue of The Atlantic, an anonymous college professor writes in the basement of the Ivory Tower, an article about how the widely held view that everyone has the right and the need for college is damaging to society. And joining me now to talk more about this controversial topic is Scott Stossel, deputy editor with The Atlantic. Scott, thanks for speaking with me.
Thanks for having me.
So this article definitely goes against conventional thinking that college is the way to go for everyone, and that should be our ultimate goal as a society. Why did The Atlantic choose to bring this topic up?
We thought it was an important issue, and we thought it was responsibly argued. As it happens, this piece, as happens occasionally, rarely I would even say, just came across the transom. It's not something, it was not an argument that we were seeking to make, but we got this essay just mailed to us over the transom, and there was something about the voice of it and the argument of it and the fact that the author, as you mentioned, an anonymous professor at a Northeastern college, it was almost a cri de coeur. I mean, he was not writing this as a kind of polemic against college education for everyone. He's somebody who deeply believes in that ideal of universal college education and believes in the value of liberal arts education for everyone. And that's why it's so poignant for him when he, every year when he comes to time to grade the papers of his students, he finds that a serious percentage of them, I think at one point he says, you know, 9 out of every 15 in any given year, he fails them, which raises in his mind the question of, you know, are we holding up an ideal that's impossible to sustain, that, you know, at the lower reaches of higher education, at places where he teaches, kind of colleges of last resort, as he calls them, you know, maybe the students are there kind of, whether they're there by choice or against their will for some kind of professional achievement needs, they're simply not qualified to do what we would call college work. And so this ideal, which he himself subscribes to, runs up against what he calls, you know, the reality of his red pen.
He paints a really bleak picture, I thought, you know, describing all these people who've just completed a long day's worth of work, and then they have to trudge to class and sit there and go through English 101 and 102, and how some of them just aren't grasping the concept, and how he says he himself, this is his second job teaching these English classes. And I just was curious to know a little bit more about him. We don't know who he is, Professor X, he's called. Why did you decide to let him write this anonymously?
Well, we realized that, and this is something that we did debate a little bit internally, and but we realized, you know, he really would have been putting his job in jeopardy by if you were to use his actual name. And, you know, there's something to know that he is raising a kind of taboo subject here, because it is such it's so deeply inscribed in our notion of the American dream that, you know, from the GI Bill and beyond, that, you know, everyone should aspire to upward mobility and to college education. And for someone to be arguing against that, particularly somebody who's in higher education himself, it's got a kind of an elitist component to it, so it's sort of taboo. So I guess the notion that having him do it anonymously kind of reinforced the sense that this is a taboo subject that he's raising, but one that's worth raising, because, you know, how do you, as elitist as it is, you know, he's writing honestly from his own perspective, and so how do you, and this is what he's wrestling with, how do you manage this ideal against the reality of all these students who maybe aren't prepared for college education as we define it. I mean, at one point he says, you know, I could compromise and give better grades, but these papers really aren't college papers in any true sense of the word. He'd be demeaning the idea of a college paper if he were to give them a passing grade.
Did you come to any sort of consensus in your newsroom whether or not that it is truly a disservice to impose college on as many people as we can? Or did you come to the consensus that maybe, hey, you know, even if they're not 100% qualified to take college-level classes, at least they're out there and trying to better themselves?
I mean, I don't think there was any kind of consensus we knew that this would be a somewhat controversial piece, and certainly not everybody on the staff agrees with the thesis, for starters, and some, I'm sure, disagree with the very idea that we would publish it, because it does run so much against it's sort of anti-democratic and arguably sounds elitist. But it's and I think everyone here would say that does subscribe to the ideal of universal college education, and, you know, certainly speaking for myself, and I think all of my colleagues, you know, we do believe in the value of a liberal arts education for, whether that's for the president of the United States or the president of a Fortune 500 company, or for, you know, the janitor at the local school that he refers to in his piece. But it's a piece that doesn't really have any answers. I mean, it's raising question, because he doesn't say what do you do about this, and it's kind of a racket too that these colleges will willingly enlist any of these or enroll any of these students, knowing that a certain number of them are going to fail and have to re-enroll again and again in order to, you know, get promoted at the local hospital or in the local police station. So the next step is, you know, what do you do about this? And this is a hard question that I don't have the answer to, and I don't think Professor X does either.
Well, it was interesting you mentioned the word elite. You know, is it an elitist idea that not everyone is ready for college? Or, you know, from Professor X's standpoint, is it just, you know, the way it is, the unpolitically correct way that way that it is. Not everybody is, you know, possesses the same skills that everyone else does, and so certain people are more cut out for things than other people.
Right.
Maybe not a popular idea, but, you know.
Right. It is politically incorrect. And he doesn't get into great detail about why this is the case, although he does kind of gesture in the direction. You know, are there some people who just, rather through genes or through poor, you know, maybe is the solution, you know, better secondary education to get everybody up to where their cognitive deficits or whatever you want to call them aren't such that they can't do college level work? Is it, you know, a Head Start program so that kids who are born in less kind of culturally enriched homes have the access to early education that they need in order to stimulate their brains to grow? Is it, you know, there are a lot of reasons why at age 18, or in this case, a lot of these people are coming later in life at age 25 or 35 or coming to college and simply don't have the cultural literacy or the IQ or whatever it is that's necessary to do college level work. There are many reasons why that is, but it's simply a fact that there are a certain percentage who are not ready to do college-level work. So aren't we setting them up for failure by insisting that they do college-level work? I mean, that requires either a redefinition of what college-level work is or a redefinition of who's actually qualified to go to college, or C, we have to somehow improve. If we're really to sustain the ideal, we have to improve potentially any number of things so that you have more, you know, fewer percentage of people arriving at college simply unprepared to do the work.
You're probably expecting a lot of feedback on this article, right?
Yes, I am. It'll be interesting to see how many letters to the editor we get. We know already that it's gotten a lot of web traffic, and it's been much discussed in various education blogs on the internet. But I'll be very curious to see what kind of response there is, either from, you know, students and from fellow professors, and whether Professor X is sort of roundly denounced for even raising this, or if there are other voices popping up saying, you know, this is something that's an unspoken reality and that you know, ought to be talked about more. I'm very curious to see what we get.
Scott Stossel is the deputy editor of The Atlantic. He was talking to me about an article in the magazine's June issue in the basement of the Ivory Tower. Scott, thanks for speaking with me.
Thanks so much for having me.
Good morning. You're with 91.7 WVXU. It's 7:32 and 75 degrees.
Is your car making a strange noise?
If it is, tell us about it. We've probably heard it before.
Just kind of like a whisking sound. No.
It's
no,
not.
That's really not it. Hey, stop it. You're both scaring me now.
We're Click and Clack the Tappet Brothers. Join us for Car Talk.
10 a.m. Saturday and 2 p.m. Sunday on 91.7 WVXU Cincinnati.
English can be a complicated language. There are all kinds of double meanings, difficult spellings, and odd rules, some of which I'm sure I'm probably breaking right now. And to top it off, it turns out that everything you know about English is wrong. At least that's according to author Bill Broha. That's the title of his latest book, and he's also a former editor of Writer's Digest. And Bill joins me now to talk about our evolving language. Bill, thanks for being here.
You're welcome. It's a pleasure.
So my first question is, why did you have to write this book? Because I was quite happy thinking that the little bit I knew about grammar was correct, at least the I before E except after C rule. But I see that even that is not correct.
I've always been fascinated by how language has changed over the centuries and have been surprised by how it's changed. And the things that we disdain these days were quite common in days of yore. Things that we champion or speak regularly were once distasteful, both in word meaning and in elocution. And it's those very surprises that in a broad range of areas, including word histories where we really don't understand where the word came from, in rules that we use, like don't end a sentence with a preposition, which is, frankly, a lot of hooey. And that sort of thing. And I wanted to talk about revealing the complexities and the fascinations that I have with the language in this book.
Now, I remember English classes, and even though I'm a writer and you would think I would be fascinated with grammar, to me, it seemed like it was very dry when they taught it. But in your book, you seem to think that it doesn't really have to be that way.
The beauty of the English language is that it's a very flexible, very vibrant language. And we have a lot of strange rules and strange non-rules and exceptions. And that gives English a great power for variation, especially when you're writing. It gives you word choices. Our vocabulary is incredible. The variations in spellings actually help give a texture to the language. And when you look at some of the past elements of the language and how it's evolved, and you immerse yourself in that, it gives you greater power as a writer to speak eloquently.
Now, what about slang? You say that you're not really opposed to it. And in fact, you say that ain't is not a bad word.
Ain't is not a bad word at all.
That's surprising.
Now, ain't in the wrong situations is an inappropriately used word. But is it bad grammar? Is it bad English? Absolutely not, because it fills a hole. It fills a void that no other word does. We have various contractions for you are, they are, but I am has no contraction. Ain't fills that void. And in fact, was considered proper English at one point in our history, but it lost its cachet.
What about other slang words? Do you think they add something to the language, or do you think that they take away some of its formality, or, you know, make it sound a little, I don't know, I guess that is the word, less formal?
It all depends on the situation. If you need a formal elocution, then that's what you use. You're not going to use ain't in a job interview. You're not going to use ain't in running for president, but informal situations, there's always the appropriate informality in speaking with friends, in speaking loosely, in a very first-person conversational article, for instance. It's all situational.
One of the things I noticed going through your book is that you have a section on redundant words. Now, in my profession, we are told that you do not use redundancies. If you can say something in one word, you use one word instead of using two. But you say in some cases, it's okay.
Absolutely. One of my other projects is a book called Write Tight, which addresses that very subject on the whole idea that if you don't have to use the phrase the city of Cincinnati, for instance, because in the audience, especially listening to this broadcast, understands that Cincinnati is a city. If they don't understand that, then they've got problems. But there are certain places where, for the rhythm of a sentence, for the intent of the sentence, having something that's a little more loquacious, you stretch it out a little bit, is very much appropriate. As a quick example, the phrase pass away. Now, John F. Kennedy did not pass away. John F. Kennedy was assassinated. To say that he passed away really blunts the impact of that very important historical event. But you're not going to come up to your dear friend and say, "Yeah, sorry your parent keeled over." It's all situational once again.
What about the internet? And not even just the internet, technology in general, blogs, text messaging, all of those things have changed the language. And I saw that you don't like emoticons, the little faces people type using punctuation marks in emails and texts.
They're crutches. And I look on the whole subject of internet communications from two separate ways. The emoticons are crutches, but we use crutches all the time. And it depends on what in the next 20 years, 30 years, next century is going to survive. I even make a claim that the emoticon, the colon, and end parentheses to indicate the smiley face could, over the years, become a standard punctuation mark, because we have a punctuation mark to indicate surprise. We have one to indicate question, but we don't have a punctuation mark that indicates that a sentence is intended to be humorous or light. Now, do I champion that? No, I don't think I do. But if it happened, that's very much a part of the way that the language is evolving. One of the examples that I use is a thing I spotted on the internet where the writer had used the letters "you are" to indicate the phrase Y-O-U-A-R-E. Mm-hmm. And that I spotted on the internet because it was on the Oxford English Dictionary. It was quoting the author of Far From the Madding Crowd more than a century ago. So, you know, everything old is new again, and everything new is going to be old again at some point. The other part that I find interesting about texting and chat rooms and everything else is probably our generation, or the generation right now, the people that are on the internet right now, are probably more keyboard savvy and writing savvy than any generation we've had previously because of all of that.
That's interesting because you hear a lot of people, you know, just railing against text messaging because it's, you know, teaching kids to write with abbreviations and emoticons. But really, they might be writing more than kids who didn't text message in the first place.
And abbreviations and such have always been a part of the language. RSVP.
That's right.
And nobody frowns at that.
Right now, it's actually kind of formal.
Mm-hmm,
right?
Exactly.
Well, so obviously the language has evolved over the years. Do you see it, I mean, obviously you do see it continuing to change in the future. What else besides, you know, possible smiley faces as punctuation marks can we expect?
I think we're going to see further simplification of the language. There's going to be a lot of hoo-ha and fighting against, say, simplification of spelling. I'm thinking of light beer mm-hmm. from Miller, L-I-T-E, where when that came out, it seemed like the silent letter Anti-Defamation League went all apoplectic because, oh my goodness, how can you spell it that way? Well, lights was originally spelled that way. Huh. And the GH was inserted into the word at some point in its history. So when we have something like through being spelled T-H-R-U, is that bad? I'm not sure I'm going to champion that one, but it's also a part of the language. And there's certain instances like the talking about a certain type of roadway called a throughway. Spelling it with T-H-R-U is about the only way to do it because it looks odd if you spell it the other way.
Bill Broha is the author of Everything You Know About English Is Wrong, which is available now. Bill, thank you so much for speaking with me.
A pleasure.
One more thing you might think is true is that bigger is better. Not so, according to commentator Martin Giesbrecht. This morning, he shares his essay, Small is Beautiful.
Several decades ago, during America's post-World War II glory years, when everything here was growing bigger and better faster than ever before, a little paperback book called Small is Beautiful became a surprise bestseller. It was written by an otherwise unknown British economist who suggested that we would all be better off if the important products in our lives could be made smaller, more efficient, less energy-consuming, and scaled down to human dimensions. Smaller cars would be easier on gas, easier to park, and more fun to drive. Smaller houses would be less costly to heat and cool, and would certainly involve smaller mortgages. Less gigantic cities would ease the pain and cost of commuting and may even increase interpersonal relationships and the sense of community. Smaller farms would mean less industrialized agriculture, a greater variety of crops, and gentler care of the land. Above all, small would mean less depletion of our natural resources and less pollution of our environment. Perhaps in spite of ourselves, we've taken this message to heart. Our cars have stopped growing forever bigger, and they're a lot more fuel efficient now. Our houses, especially the McMansions that seem to define today's dream house, continue to grow larger, but on smaller and smaller lots. They have also grown much more energy efficient. And a vast array of consumer products, think of computers, TVs, cell phones, flashlights, space heaters, vacuum cleaners, electric hand tools, and so on, have become less bulky, lighter, and easier on energy. The whole purpose behind this development was and is to give us more bang for the buck. Almost incidentally, it also helped us economize our natural resources and minimize our environmental pollution, so we can enjoy more affluent and longer lives than we would have been able to enjoy had we not downsized and miniaturized in this way. Small seems to be the key to being beautiful in other ways, too. In order to survive into the 21st century, the former Soviet Union broke itself up into 15 new smaller states. Italy, Scotland, and Belgium are each thinking about splitting in two. The United Nations, which began in 1945 in a world with 45 nations, now has 192. The International Monetary Fund, which ranks these 192 countries by income per capita, finds that the smallest nations top the list. In fact, the three richest nations each have populations smaller than the 5 million population of our state of Minnesota. The fourth richest nation, our United States, a giant with about 300 million people, may be helped to rank this high because, as our name explains, we are actually made up of 50 smaller states. As if to further prove the point, four of the most populous countries in the world, India, China, Brazil, and Indonesia, also rank among the lowest in per capita income. Beyond simple comparisons of per capita income, the London Economist Intelligence Unit finds that 8 of the 10 most peaceful countries, meaning those with the lowest homicide and imprisonment rates, have populations below 10 million. The World Economic Forum's Competitive Index and the Human Development Index find that small countries dominate the top 10 in their rankings. Being small is probably easier now than it used to be. Globalization and freer trade and the ease of electronic communication and finance, the existence of the UN and NATO and other international peace and order-preserving organizations means that the small have less to fear from the mighty than in the past. Perhaps by extension, this may also apply to corporations, churches, charities, universities, shopping malls, and many other entities that have grown huge in recent decades. Merger and acquisition enthusiasts may want to think twice about this. Small may turn out to be more beautiful for them, too. And one last not necessarily relevant thought. James Harrington said it back in the 1600s. I can think of nothing more dangerous than debate in a crowd.
Commentator Martin Giesbrecht is Professor Emeritus of Economics at Northern Kentucky University.
Summer's here and Weekend America is celebrating. In our new summer travel series, we'll bring you the sounds of vacation.
That is really good. Okay, stop licking your arm. You got bug spray on it. Oh my God, okay, hang on. How is it?
Good.
From camping trips to spa retreats, Weekend America hits the road. And who knows what we'll discover. Join us for the next Weekend America. Saturdays at noon on 91.7 WVXU Cincinnati.
This week in the front row, Betsy Ross visits with J.T. Roberts. He's general manager of the Cincinnati Kings Men's Professional Soccer Club.
The Cincinnati Kings Soccer Club is back for another season, but with some changes this year. As you might remember, the Cincinnati Kings launched 3 years ago, and we have had some changes. And here to talk about that is the general manager of the Cincinnati Kings, J.T. Roberts. J.T., thanks for being with us in the front row.
Good morning, Betsy.
I had to glance at you because I was adding up the years. It has been 3 years since Cincinnati Kings launched.
Yes, yes. It goes quick.
Well, you might remember, for those of you who are soccer fans, Cincinnati Kings played for the first couple of years at Xavier University and was part of the United Soccer League's second division.
Correct.
And there are some changes this year now for the Kings.
There are some changes, yes. In October of 2007, we bought an $11.3 million sports complex in Northern Kentucky in Wilder, and that'll be the new home for the Kings. So that's a big change in itself. The second thing that we did, and the reasons that we did this, is we dropped down to the Premier Development League, which is the amateur-based league within the USL, United Soccer League. So our roster now will be comprised of college players along with some youth players. And the interesting part there and the unique part there is that we've also developed a complete soccer academy. We have U8s through now our PDL, the Premier Development League team. So it's the only one in this area, and we're really happy about it.
Now, what are the changes besides, obviously, you've dropped down? This is more for players who see themselves in a few years as being professionals. I mean, I guess
Correct.
Developmental is the key
Exactly.
word of all of that.
Exactly. This environment, while we consider it dropping down, if you will, from professional to amateur, this environment is actually more intense. We have players that are coming in from IU, from Ohio State, which was the national runners-up this past year for mm-hmm. for the men's, Valpo, Wright State, Xavier University. So these guys that are coming in will be training and playing throughout the summer, going back to their universities. But the real reason they're with us is to move on to bigger and better things after college. They want to make soccer a business. They want to play overseas. They want to play in the MLS. And last year, the Premier Development League, which the Kings are in this year, last year the MLS drafted 45 of those players from the PDL. So it's a real opportunity for those guys to do what they want to do and get paid for it.
Now, what will be the competition this coming season?
It's a regionally based setup. We go as far north as Toronto. We're as far south as we'll go. We head into Chicago, into Michigan for a few games, West Virginia as well. So the competition is stiff. Again, all of these clubs that we'll be playing against have the same makeup of college players that want to move on. You know, you're looking at your top Division I players that'll move on to the professional ranks someday.
Now, we've talked mainly about the Cincinnati Kings themselves, but we're talking with J.T. Roberts, who's general manager of the Cincinnati Kings. We've talked about the Kings, but really what gets the Kings going, the drive behind the Kings, is really your youth program, and that has really exploded over the last year or so.
Correct. Since day one, the owner, Yacoub Abdullahi, and myself have always said that in order to survive, especially in the business of soccer, you need to have a youth program underneath it that wears the same colors, plays the same, under the same name, and would support your team, the older team. So what we've done is we've combined with Northern Kentucky United, which is the largest soccer club in this area, along with the Cardinal Soccer Club from the east side of Cincinnati, and all of those players will be playing under the King's name, which is going to be called the King's Soccer Academy.
Mm-hmm.
We have tryouts kicking off in June. So we've gone from one men's team to well over 120 teams that'll be playing in the red and black under the King's brand, which is something that the MLS has started to do 2 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
And they understand the importance of getting those kids and getting that buy-in at the young age.
What is the attraction of soccer in this area? And you've been involved in soccer in just about every level here in the Cincinnati area, still involved in youth soccer as a coach yourself. But what is the attraction? There are so many youngsters. Last I heard, we were still number two behind Kansas City area in soccer participation for youngsters. What's the attraction in this area?
I just think it's something that just about anybody can play. I mean, it's not something where you need a lot of money. It's not something where you need an awful lot of space. And the good thing about soccer, especially for at the younger ages, is that there's not a lot of standing. Kids are playing, and at the end of the day, that's all kids want to do. They just want to go out and play. And so I think that's the attraction about it. And everybody's doing it. On a weekend, you drive by, soccer fields are packed, and kids are out there just having fun. So I think it's simply put, kids just want to play. They don't want to stand around. They just want to go out and run around. So
You've been to the MLS. You've been to the Peak. You've seen how the pros play. You've been involved in the United Soccer Leagues. You've been involved in the high schools here.
Mm-hmm.
What kind of players do we have? I think we always hear about Heather Mitz. You know, she's kind of the poster girl
Sure.
for professional soccer here in this area because she's done so well. But overall, what kind of skill level do you see here with our players?
In the greater Cincinnati area, I think it's definitely above average. especially on the female side. The boys' side is starting to catch up as well. And there's two reasons. One, the number of kids that are playing, especially at the younger ages, they're just getting out, touching the ball earlier. The second reason is the coaching staff in this area. You have a lot of people that are educated in the sport, people like myself that have played at various levels and want to give back to the kids. And so with that, with the number of kids playing and the number of people that are able to properly train these kids, the greater Cincinnati has tremendous talent. Tremendous talent.
All right, so now the $64,000 question that everybody brings up when you're talking about soccer. All right, it's popular with the kids.
Right.
It's popular in high schools. It's becoming more popular in the college level. Why is it that MLS, although it's still alive, which is, you know, a plus
yes,
right there.
Yes, 10 years plus.
Why isn't it bigger than what it is?
You know, I've always said this. It's the cool factor, and it's soccer in the States is not on television. You don't have your superstars on the commercials drinking the beverages and wearing the cool shoes and things along those lines. And the third thing is the salary. And I think those three factors add up to what I call the cool factor, if you will, with kids. And right now the MLS is doing something that's very smart. They're still alive because they haven't paid big bucks other than one player in particular.
And we'll talk about him in a second.
But they've been consistent and they have a plan, which is longevity. And so it's continuing to grow. MLS franchises are popping up across the country. And the beauty of it is they're playing in soccer-specific stadiums, which is huge because soccer MLS game being played at Paul Brown Stadium with 10 to 15,000 people in a 60,000-seat stadium just doesn't do it justice. So.
And certainly Columbus has done it right. Columbus Crew Stadium is just an awesome stadium, but it's 20,000.
Right.
And so when you have a 15 or 18,000 crowd there, it looks awesome.
Right.
And it's just a perfect stadium. Nice layout, nice parking. It's very handy for fans to get there. Now, David Beckham. He comes in here. He's kind of like the Wayne Gretzky now of soccer. Wayne Gretzky comes to L.A. and tries to revive hockey in the United States. All of a sudden, David Beckham comes to L.A. He's paid the big bucks. Mm-hmm. There ain't nobody cooler than David Beckham, at least from my standpoint.
That is true.
Okay, so is that a good thing or is that a bad thing?
I think it's a good thing. He brings that cool factor that I just alluded to earlier. Anytime you hear his name, yeah, on the television, you know, people just stop. Even if you don't like soccer, you stop to see what's going on, what's Beckham doing. And anytime you can draw attention to the game of soccer, which he has done, it's a positive. I think, you know, you see it with kids. They emulate stars. They emulate athletes. And we see it at practices all the time. Kids will watch Beckham, what he did last night. They'll see snippets on ESPN or their local sports television shows, and they'll go out and do that. And that's how the sport of soccer is going to grow. And so, you know, we see the Kobe Bryants, we see the LeBron James, we see the Derek Jeters, and kids go in the backyard and try to do that. But we don't see enough of those soccer stars on television. So with Beckham here, I think it's only a positive.
And this comes from J.T. Roberts, who was voted a couple of years ago the...
Are we out of time?
No, not yet. What was the exact title J.T.?
I'm getting old. I'm drawing a blank on that title.
Yeah, I think it was something about like the sexiest man in Cincinnati or something like that.
Sad state for Cincinnati.
So there's a cool factor right there. J.T. Roberts, the executive director and the general manager of the Cincinnati Kings, playing out at Town Country this year. J.T., thanks for being with us on the front row, and I think you're blushing.
Thank you, Betsy, and I am.
Tomorrow on Cincinnati Edition, Ohio is expected to once again play a critical role in November's general election. Will the rebranding of the Republican Party help the GOP here? We'll take a look. And as we celebrate Superman's 70th birthday, we'll take you to the Cartoon Research Library at Ohio State University tomorrow morning at 7.
Cincinnati Edition's executive producer is Jerry Donnelly. The show is produced by Bruce Ellis. Production assistants are Kevin Rowinski, Andy Ellis, and Chelsea Vandedrink. For Cincinnati Edition, I'm Katie Orr on 91.7 WVXU Cincinnati. It's 75 degrees at 8 o'clock.